MacCast, Sunday, February 14th, 2016. Hey, MacGeeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for MacGeeks by MacGeeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, it's Valentine's Day as I sit here recording this, so I guess this is, in a way, my little Valentine to you, my little geek Valentine. Feels a little bit like, remember passing those little Valentines out at school, where you'd give, you know, you'd have one for each kid? Yeah, I feel a little awkward like that again. But anyway, I'm very appreciative of you being a listener to the MacCast. Glad to have you back here with me for another episode, whatever day it might be. And we've got a lot of good stuff to talk about in this episode. We're going to give you a little update on some new and recent items that have been discovered in the various beta versions of software that Apple's been putting out. We're kind of between releases right now. We're sort of waiting, building up to this March event that's been rumored and we've been talking about. So we've got betas to talk about. We got a lot of speculation of what Apple is going to have coming next. So we're going to talk about some of their investments in the augmented reality and virtual reality spaces, also some of the countries and stuff that they're building facilities in. And it's a very interesting list of what Apple is up to in terms of building out their little empire globally. We're going to talk about what's happening with processors in the next generation of iPhones. Also some security issues to talk about, a couple of various security things that cropped up over the past week or so. We've got updates on the Apple Car. What's happening with Apple's streaming TV service? Is that still a thing that's going on? And also a little issue, a little hiccup with USB-C cables, which is interesting given what we talked about last week about that little report, you know, the guy over at Amazon doing quality checks on USB-C cables. Apple ran into a problem with them as well, but it's a little bit different. We're going to fill you in on that. So we've got all of that and then some of your feedback, a little update on what's happening with iTunes Match and iTunes Radio. We're going to talk about a little bug, potential bug that could bite you with the iPhone, a little obscure one, but still something interesting cropped up this week. Troubleshooting your Mac, especially when shutting it down. Some tips and tricks for you there. Talk about deleting music on iOS, and then I have a great thing of the moment for you, something I'm very excited about that I've been playing around with for the past week or so, at least when I can. Don't have a lot of time for that sort of stuff, but fun little thing there as well. Should be a great episode, but before we get into it, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Squarespace. You know, Squarespace has everything you need to set up the perfect website, and you can do it within a matter of hours rather than days. Typically, setting up a website, big ordeal. With Squarespace, they make it super easy. You know, and at some point, you're probably going to need a website for something. It's just the world we live in. I build websites all the time. You might have a new business that you're setting up. Maybe you want to set up something for your kids' sports team. You have a club, a group, an organization you want to create a website for. Maybe you're doing a family reunion and you want to post family photos and little updates there. It could just be a personal blog, whatever. You're an artist, you want to show off your art, a photographer, you want to set up a photo gallery. Lots of reasons why you might need a website. And what I love about Squarespace is they give you everything you need. They provide all the tools that you're going to need to set up a great looking website and get it up and running fast. And, you know, I wanted a website for a special MacCast event we did about a year ago at Disneyland. And I used Squarespace to build out that website. And it was great because I got the domain that I needed. I got all the hosting, got all the design tools, was able to pick out a really great theme. And what I loved about it was that it was responsive. So I knew it was going to work on mobile devices as well as on the desktop. I was able to quickly add a welcome page, set up a great slideshow slider. This is all stuff that would take, you know, programming and JavaScript and a bunch of HTML and CSS to put together. And I would just use the drag and drop tools. I pulled in the images I wanted. I knew I needed a page with a calendar and maps. They had widgets for that, so everybody would know where to go and how to find the location. And it had all the social media integration built into it as well. So we could help promote it and get it on Twitter and Facebook and all that stuff. And I had it online within hours. So from the time I got the idea to do the event, I was able to sign up for the website and put it online and have the information and URL to give out on my show. It was quick and easy. And, you know, my needs for that site were simple, but it doesn't have to be a simple website. You know, I just use the template and the drag and drop tools, but if you need more advanced stuff, they have you covered there as well. You can get e-commerce integration, analytics tools. You can even dig into the code and truly just make the site your own, tweak it out to your heart's desire. You can really take it, you know, from basics all the way through advanced stuff. And with Squarespace, you get it all. Great sites that are professionally designed regardless of your skill level, no coding required. They're intuitive and easy to use tools, which are great. I mean, really best in class in the industry. And you get a free domain name if you sign up for a year. And best of all, you can try it all for free. Start your free trial today at squarespace.com/mattcast. And you can try everything out, get up and running with a great looking website. And when you decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure to use the offer code MACCAST, M-A-C-C-A-S-T, at checkout to get 10% off your first purchase. So a big thank you to Squarespace for their support of the show. Squarespace, you should. Apple's had a number of betas out for OS X, tvOS, iOS, watchOS. They're pushing out updates to developers, also out on the public beta. And this week, there were a couple things that came out that were interesting to take a look at. In OS X, 10.11.4, the next update for OS X on the Mac, the Notes application got a little bit of love. Actually, it's been getting quite a bit of love, but it looks like in this latest update, Apple has added support for importing from the Evernote, the .enex file format, which means it's looking like you're going to be able to bring in your stuff, bring over notes from Evernote into Apple's Note application. And they've been really expanding the feature set of Notes to bring in a lot of functionality like checklists and other kinds of advanced formatting. And I've heard a lot of people who are very interested in moving potentially from other systems into just the built-in Notes app in OS X and in iOS. And we had some of the first hints of the import functionality coming when some of the menu options popped up in an earlier version of the beta build, but now it's looking like there's actual functionality in there to import the notes. Also, Apple's VP of marketing, Brian Krall, made some comments to PC users saying that Evernote capture support would be arriving in OS X Notes pretty soon. And the feature, apparently, according to the reports, seems to be fairly good at converting Evernote's advanced formatting, although it's not quite perfect. I think some of the comparisons being made are to it being very similar to support for Microsoft Word documents in Pages. So it's good, not perfect. I don't know if it ever could be perfect, but exciting news if you're interested in maybe looking at Apple's Notes application and might be switching over from Evernote. On the tvOS side, we've got tvOS 9.2. The third beta of that came out this past week or so, and it added dictation support and support for Siri search of the App Store. So now you can dictate things like usernames and passwords and other keyboard input right into the text box. Now, it seems when you do the update, once this comes out, what it's going to do is it's going to prompt you, ask you if you want to install dictation support right after you upgrade. And then once you do, when you're performing any kind of text input, there will be an additional option to press and use the Siri button on the remote and then dictate the text right into the text box or the text field. And while you're dictating, you will see a little live level meter there on the screen so you know it's capturing your voice and dictating stuff in there. Now, I'm kind of curious about this for passwords. I don't know about you, but I'm a big fan of 1Password. I use 1Password generated passwords. So they're, you know, 24, 30 characters long combination of numbers and letters. I don't know. I'm trying to decide, is it going to be easier to dictate that stuff in, especially like special symbols and switching between upper and lowercase? I don't know if that's going to be the total solution. Right now, I've been using Apple's remote app, and that works pretty well. And that was integrated in a prior update. I think the last update that came out added support for the Apple remote app. So I may keep doing that. Dictation, though, could come in handy for some third-party apps, and hopefully it's something that's opened up and made available. And these two features also, I guess, you know, the Siri support for searching the App Store. So now you can use your Siri voice commands to search for new apps on the App Store, on the Apple TV. Those are being added in addition to some of the earlier features in earlier betas that we've seen. Support for Bluetooth keyboards, which is coming. iCloud photo library support and support for live photos. Also, you're going to be able to put apps into folders in the next update. And there's that whole new app switcher interface that more mimics what we have on iOS. And then developers also are gaining support for MapKit. So they're going to be able to integrate the mapping data and information into those third-party apps and make those more useful. So tvOS 9.2 is looking to be a pretty significant update to tvOS and should make the Apple TV much more usable. I'm kind of excited about that update that's coming. Now, this isn't specifically anything related to the Watch OS update, but Apple apparently is looking to hire a software engineer for their, quote, clock face team. So it's making it sound like Apple may be working on some new clock faces, maybe possibly some new complications for some upcoming update. Now, it's not clear if this would be part of the watch updates that we're expecting Apple to do in March, and that's really just some cosmetic things. A lot of the reports have been saying Apple's going to come up with some new watch bands and watch combinations, so it's not going to be a full update to Apple Watch 2, but just a minor update with, you know, a few more buying options. And it would make sense that maybe along with that we get some new watch faces and complications, but it's not clear if that'll happen. Regardless, it looks like Apple is trying to build out that team a little bit more. And I think it'd be a good thing to have some additional built-in options for watch faces. I'm hoping at some point Apple opens that up to third parties. And I think we've talked about this in the past. I think there's a lot of some interesting things that could go on there. But also, you know, better designed and just more interesting complications, more options. I think really with the watch faces, what I'd like to see is more options that have different support for the complications. There's really, if you want a lot of complications in the design of your watch, you really only have one or two faces that you can choose from. I personally use modular, but I'd love to see some analog faces or some of the photo faces that maybe have a little bit more support for some of the complications and a little more data and information on the watch, because that really for me seems what it's good at, right? A quick glance at my wrist gives me a lot of the information about my day, and that's why I like the modular face. So it'd be great if I could have some more design choices and options to play around with. And then for future versions of the operating system, iOS 10, we're hearing little inklings about what might be happening there. Specifically, Apple seems to be stepping up their mapping efforts, really trying to improve maps and the functionality for iOS 10. A lot of people have been spotting more of the Apple cars, the little vans, I guess they really are, with all the sensors on top of them around the streets. And Apple really seems to be gearing up there. And now they're not keeping it so much a secret that they have these vehicles on the road. The vehicles actually have window decals that say they're Apple Maps vans, and I think they have a URL on there and everything. You can even now get a listing, as a matter of fact, on Apple's website if you want to see where the vans are going to be. If they're going to be in your area, maps.apple.com/vehicles will let you go and see when and where they're going to be driving around different areas. And they have onboard cameras and LiDAR and high-sensitivity GPS. And what appears to be happening is Apple is gathering a lot more data on the ground. They're also backing up that data with what's called ground truth operations, and that's basically verifying once the vans have gone out, driven around and captured different roads and locations via GPS, they're matching that up and making sure they have much more accurate data. They're also doing things like environmental capture, which is scanning and capturing data on the surrounding areas around the vans, things like depth maps and photographs. So there's some of us that are hoping that means that Apple might have some kind of street view type functionality in iOS 10. And I would love to see that functionality come back, because it's something I've missed ever since Apple moved away from Google Maps. But looking like a lot of great things coming for future versions of the operating system. We'll keep an eye on the betas and what's next, and let you know what to expect when Apple does the next software, their next software updates. So a big question on everybody's mind seems to be, what is next for Apple? What is the next big technology beyond the iPhone, beyond the iPad? And more, it's looking like the next big thing is, at least one next big thing, I guess, is going to be moving beyond the screen, just the basic screen. So a lot of companies, Google, Microsoft, are moving into and doing a lot of research very publicly in the virtual reality, augmented reality space. We know Samsung has their Gear VR system that they put out, or platform that they put out. And everybody's been looking at Apple going, well, what are you guys up to? Well, in a research note acquired by Apple Insider, Piper Jaffray analyst Jean Munster has some very interesting thoughts on how Apple may be moving into the augmented reality and virtual reality space. He basically says he believes Apple will set up an iOS-driven ecosystem for augmented reality and virtual reality, at least to begin with, that they would have products ready to go with a platform that sort of surrounds the iPhone as soon as by 2018. And looking on LinkedIn, he says Apple has hired at least 141 people with backgrounds in augmented reality. So they're certainly building up a staff. They've also been making some acquisitions recently that I think we talked about on the last episode of the MacCast, various companies surrounding the virtual reality, augmented reality space. So bringing in acqui-hires. And what Munster thinks is going on, at least in the short term, is that there's going to be this natural progression from personal technology, things like smartphones, into augmented reality, virtual reality, wearable style devices. So maybe not our generation moving into those sorts of things, but the next generation, they're going to be more comfortable wearing these kinds of devices and displays on their bodies. Things I would imagine like goggles or Google Glass, hopefully not as bulky and a little bit more stylish, but you get the idea. We're moving into this space. And so in the short term, by 2018, what's probably going to happen is Apple's going to put together some sort of framework, some sort of programs, and then let third-party developers basically certify accessories to tap into the AR, augmented reality, and virtual reality technologies that Apple will have built into the iPhone, into iOS, maybe even into iPads. I don't know if the Apple Watch will play in there somehow, but imagine something that your iPhone would go into or plug into that would then drive the virtual reality, augmented reality experience. And Apple would have a program much like Made for iPhone, something that would certify devices that were compatible with iOS. And we're already seeing some products come out. I think I told you about my thing of the moment being the ViewMaster virtual reality, basically Google Cardboard display that you put your iPhone into. And there's some amazing things you can do with that. The Google Street View app, for example, has amazing street views that you can go through in virtual reality with the ViewMaster viewer or with your cardboard viewer in your iPhone that lets you explore the entire world. You can go under the ocean, you can explore remote trails, and that's because they're crowdsourcing gathering of that data. Within the app itself, you can capture 360 virtual realities and submit them into Google's database. So this will kind of be the first step by Apple into the space, is basically opening up the software, the OS, and the development environment to allow developers to kind of better create these experiences with iPhone devices. And then eventually that could lead into Apple developing their own hardware and devices in the space. I think that's a natural progression, but that's not something that Munster says he sees happening for at least 15 years. I think it's going to happen a little bit sooner than that timeline, personally, but certainly it makes sense that the initial foray is going to be with some sort of platform that others can tap into. And I think that by 2018, maybe even a little sooner time frame, depending upon how it goes. And again, Apple seems to be heavily investing in the space along with others in the tech industry. And I think that makes a lot of sense, sort of what our friend Ken Ray calls moving to that Star Trek experience, the Star Trek experience, basically moving beyond the screen. If you look at Star Trek, very infrequently are they ever interacting with a screen. It's done through voice, it's done through the holodeck, however it might be. So moving into those technologies as being the next generation. And it's going to be an interesting time, and it's interesting to see how Apple is moving into this space. And I thought the insights from Gene Munster were very interesting. As mentioned at the top of the show, I have quite a few little kind of security things to talk about in this episode. I'm just going to kind of blast through these one after the other. The first one that came out earlier in the week was Intego was warning Mac users of a fake flash update that apparently was installing scareware. Basically, spyware, scareware, adware, whatever you want to call it, where once it gets in your system, it starts popping up these error messages and basically trying to do phishing, right? You've seen the error dialogues maybe, or hopefully you haven't, but at least maybe you know about them, where it'll pop up and say, oh, we noticed that your Mac is infected, call this telephone number, and then they try and get credit card information or other information out of you. So basically installing this kind of thing. It was a pop-up installer that was coming up on various websites telling you, hey, you've got a flash update to install. And then when you would download the installer and install it on your Mac, it would start, you know, this scareware stuff. And what was particularly concerning about this particular update was that it was actually signed with a valid Apple developer certificate. So once you got the pop-up and downloaded the installer, you could run it and it would bypass any of the built-in gatekeeper security. Now, luckily, Apple reacted very quickly and revoked the developer certificate, so it's not going to be a problem at this point. By the time you hear this, you know, it would not allow that to run. So the good news is the system that Apple put in place worked. They were able to quickly react to it. But some variants of this fake flash updater actually also were smart enough to download the real flash installer too. So if you did run it and it ran, it would actually sort of mask itself. It would still update the flash for you, and you wouldn't even realize it till you started getting these weird pop-ups and you didn't know where they were coming from. So the easiest way to avoid this kind of situation, because this one's pretty much shut down, I don't think too many people are going to get impacted by it at this point because Apple closed the hole by revoking that certificate. But if this does ever happen to you, if you're ever visiting a website and it pops up and says, hey, you need to update your flash or you need to update the software, the best thing to do is not update it from that little pop-up, but rather actually go to the source. So close it down, visit Adobe's website directly, their Flash Updater website, and get the download directly from the source. And that way, you know you're getting the real thing, and you might also be able to verify, hey, there actually isn't an update that I need. Now, another option is you could choose to not install Flash on your Mac at all. That's the route that I've taken, and I know a lot of others do. If you do need to run Flash in that kind of scenario, and you don't have it running at a system level, you can use a browser like Google's Chrome browser, which actually has an embedded version of Flash right in it. And the thing about that is it's sandboxed. It can't get out and impact other parts of your system. So that's what I do. Anytime I encounter a site where I need Flash or Flash is running, I just copy the URL, open that up in Chrome, and go from there. And actually, to be honest, little tip for you, if you go into Safari's advanced menu and you turn on the developer menu, it's a little checkbox. This is turn on, you know, show developer menu and menu bar. Then when you're in the menu bar, if you're on a site, you hit that and it requires Flash, you can go up to the developer menu and it has an open in option, and it will recognize any other browsers that you have installed on your Mac, including the Chrome browser, and you can just say open in Chrome. You don't even have to copy and paste the URL. You just go there. It will automatically open up Chrome, load that URL for you, and then you can interact with your Flash in a safe, sandboxed web environment. So that's how I handle that, a couple different ways to deal with that security issue. Another thing that happened this week that's interesting is a little social engineering hacking reportedly going on over in Ireland. Apple employees are saying that they're getting offers for up to 20,000 euros. That's about $23,000 US if they will hand over their Apple ID, basically their corporate login to Apple's systems, to hackers. They claim that the hackers seem to be targeting mostly junior managers who haven't been at the company very long. I would imagine this is a sure way to get fired from Apple if you're sharing or selling your Apple ID. And it's not clear that they're having, you know, they're having any success or there's any sort of leeway if anybody's really getting in. And it's not clear what kind of access they're looking for or exactly what the credentials would provide to them. But I would assume it would be that they're trying to get access to iCloud data or maybe iTunes credentials for customers, though it could also simply just be corporate espionage type data that they're after. But again, this is another one of those stories that, while interesting, it sounds like isn't really much to be concerned about because Apple has a whole counter program and obviously employees are talking about it. So Apple is aware of the issue and I'm sure their security teams are right on top of it. And then the last little security vulnerability to be concerned about this week, and again, not overly concerned, is Sparkle. There's a app updater library or API that a lot of software applications use called Sparkle. And Ars Technica was the first to, I think, report on discovering that the Sparkle updater code had a vulnerability in it that could leave Mac apps open to what's called man-in-the-middle style attacks. So what that means is if you were on a Wi-Fi network, say an open Wi-Fi network at a coffee shop or something like that, and there was a hacker there and they were watching the traffic that was going across the network, which is something they can do because you're all on the same network, and you ran a application that had the Sparkle updater built into it, and it was a version of that Sparkle updater that had this flaw, they basically could intercept that traffic and then inject other code within that, say JavaScript code, that would then run other software or other things on your system other than the software update. And they could let the software update through as well, but basically it's a vulnerability, it's an open flaw, and it was due to a flawed version of the WebKit rendering engine that was implemented in these certain builds of Sparkle. Now again, the risks to most of us are somewhat minimal because there's several things that need to happen here. First of all, you need to be on an open Wi-Fi network, say like at a coffee shop, somewhere where there's going to be a hacker who could potentially be on the same network. The other thing is the developer would have to be using one of these exposed builds of Sparkle. And the Sparkle software has been updated and patched against this vulnerability. So if you have updated apps, you are very likely not going to be exposed to this issue. And developers have been notified and made aware of the issue, so they're updating their apps very, very quickly. And then finally, the attack also relies on the developer implementing the software update not using an SSL connection, not using an encrypted connection. And that was something that actually Sparkle recommended developers do not do if they were using the software. So they're supposed to connect on a secure SSL connection, and if they didn't, then potentially you were exposed to this vulnerability. So the best thing that you could do is make sure that all of your apps are up to date. And just for the record too, Mac App Store apps were not affected by this vulnerability because those apps use the App Store's own update functionality. So they're not even allowed to use the Sparkle functionality. And again, many of the developers are already updating their apps. So the best thing to do is run your app updates, update your applications. And if you're going to do that, make sure that you do it on a private, you know, maybe your own home network. And then once you're updated, you should be able to safely once again use the software update wherever you'd like. But just a couple of vulnerabilities and things going on in OS X security that I thought were worth talking about this week. Now, from the Where Have I Heard This Before War Department, the Electronic Times is reporting that Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Corporation, better known as TSMC, has reached a deal with Apple to be the sole supplier of A-series processors for the iPhone 7. Yeah, this source seems to be the flip-flop story about who Apple's supplier of processors are. We've heard that TSMC has been tapped to be the sole supplier in the past, and then, of course, Samsung always seems to find a way to creep in there. But this time around, they're saying, nope, TSMC is going to be the company. They say the key to them getting the contract was their 10-nanometer manufacturing technology process, along with something called advanced INFO, integrated fan-out architecture. And what does that mean? I wanted to know that myself. Apparently, INFO technology stacks embedded chips on top of each other so that they can be direct mounted on the circuit board. And what that means is that it reduces the thickness and weight of the processor, something always good when you're trying to miniaturize the iPhone even further. Now, if you remember, for the iPhone 6S and 6S Plus, both Samsung and TSMC made processors, but there was kind of a controversy that broke out when benchmark testing started happening. So when the phones hit the street, you remember this? TSMC made A9 processors, Samsung made A9 processors, but for some reason, the TSMC processors seemed to have a little bit better performance. I think they used a smaller nanometer technology, and therefore reports said that they ran a little bit cooler and offered better battery life, slightly better battery life, and I mean very slightly better battery life than the Samsung processors. The variance was only about 2-3%, and Apple came out publicly and said, look, the processors, in terms of the overall performance, in terms of the overall battery life, are more or less the same. And so, you know, Apple and Samsung have always had this kind of tenuous relationship, and Apple always seems to be wanting to back away from Samsung. Considering that they're a competitor, I think that's ultimately a good thing. But still, it's really not good, I think, for Apple to rely solely on a single supplier for a major component of the iPhone. And they don't seem to do that. Historically, we've heard these stories over and over again, and then come to find out that Apple is using multiple suppliers. And with processors, it tends to be TSMC and some Samsung. So it remains to be seen. I'm kind of thinking this could happen, and Apple might start out with TSMC as the sole supplier, but as demand goes up, you know, depending upon how iPhone 7 demand goes, they could need to bring on additional suppliers, and I'm sure first in line to be tapped would be Samsung. Another strange report that came out this week is surrounding Apple's rumored iCar or Apple Car efforts. Apple Insider seems to be the biggest fans of talking about the Apple Car project. And they had a report that someone had said strange motor noises were coming from a Sunnyvale, California facility, automotive testing facility, that they believe Apple is using for the rumored car project. Now, supposedly a resident who lives near the facility had been complaining to the city of motor noises happening late at night. Now, Apple occupies 7 buildings in Sunnyvale, California, according to research done by Apple Insider. They say it comprises nearly 300,000 square feet of a large office complex in the city. And within that, they've learned that one of the buildings is supposedly owned by a mysterious company that we've talked about before called 68 Research. And if you go look at the website, it's unclear what 68 Research does. They kind of have this weird shell website. And Apple Insider really believes that this is a shell company for Apple's Apple Car project, something that they say is codenamed Project Titan and operates out of a facility that Apple internally calls SG5. Now, I don't know how all these things connect together, and Apple Insider has never made it very clear, but they do seem to be on top of all of the rumors surrounding this. The funny thing about this motor noise story to me is that if Apple is working on an electric car, you would assume that it would not be making motor noises. And most reports seem to indicate that Apple is working on an electric car. and probably an autonomous vehicle as well. And so maybe those two things are separate, or maybe they're just using engines to do some research. I don't know where this really comes from. Sometimes a lot of electric cars will actually have simulated engine noises, so maybe they were just testing that. I don't really know, but it does seem like an odd report. And still, it does seem like Sunnyvale, California is Apple Car Central. So maybe an interesting area to watch, but this could be something else. It could just be construction noise. It could be a myriad of other things. And just a funny little report coming out of Apple Insider this week. Many had hoped when Apple launched the fourth generation Apple TV that they would also finally release their rumored television subscription service. But it sounds like Apple may have gotten so fed up with the TV providers that it has decided to totally cancel the project, or at least put it on pause for now, and pardon the bad pun. In the lead up to the Apple TV release, there were rumors that Apple wanted to do a small, what they were calling light TV subscription service, probably involving about 25 channels. They were trying to get a deal that would be about $30 to $40 a month for a subscription. That's, of course, US dollars. And a big sticking point, I guess, was that a lot of the TV providers they were talking to didn't want to provide just specific channels within their vast networks of channels. And that was driving up the costs and kind of became this sticky point of putting together this sticky bundle. So Apple's insistence on it being small and costing less than $30 a month was a real deal killer. And one of the sources for the leaks, one of the best sources for the leaks regarding Apple's TV efforts, has been CBS's CEO Les Moonves. And he's now saying that at least for now, it seems like Apple has stopped talking to them about any efforts related to streaming TV. And I'm just speculating on what happened here, but based on how the Apple TV was launched and what Tim Cook said at that launch event, I think Apple just ended up going with their plan B, which was to just have apps be the way that TV providers could provide subscription services. And this seems to be backed up by some comments that Eddie Q recently made in an interview, saying that the networks are free to release their own apps with subscription services at their own prices. So for now, that's what's going on. And Apple's regrouping and looking at other ways to offer up original content to their customers, because we've been hearing these rumors, which we've been talking about for the last couple weeks, of Apple bidding for Thursday Night Football via the NFL, possibly wanting to bring that service to Apple TV customers. And also we're hearing a lot more rumors that Apple might be looking to provide their own original programming, basically producing shows like Netflix and Hulu and Amazon, some of their other competitors have been doing. And this week, we got a little glimpse of what might be Apple's first foray, little efforts in this area. There's rumors that Apple is working on an original series called Vital Signs, starring Dr. Dre. And of course, Dr. Dre is associated with Apple through their purchase of Beats. But as far as what this TV show might be, it's sounding like it's going to be something that's going to be delivered over Apple Music rather than directly over Apple TV, although I would assume through the music channel on Apple TV, you'd also be able to watch this show. It's going to be, they say, a series composed of about 6 30-minute episodes. They're describing the episodes as semi-autobiographical. It's going to be a drama, something that could resemble the film Compton. And that it's going to be very dark with a lot of violent and sexual content, including at least one episode that's rumored to contain an orgy scene. This sounds very unlike something Apple would want to associate their name with, though, to me, based on how they handle the app review process, what kinds of apps get into the App Store. Apple has produced recent music video content for Apple Music, so maybe they're viewing Apple Music content as a wholly separate sort of entity from some of their other efforts. Still, it seems a little bit odd. We were talking about this a little bit on the iOS show, and, you know, this dichotomy, I guess, you kind of get around because you look at how Apple is segregating the entertainment content on Apple TV, say through third-party providers, stuff like HBO and Showtime, That has some pretty violently graphic as well as sexually graphic content and shows available to it. And that seems to be okay. But if you try to take some of this same content and throw it into a game or an app, Apple seems to have a big objection to that. And if you remember back in the Steve Jobs days, there was a big objection to any kind of sexual content being distributed through the App Store. And now considering that a lot of these TV shows and things are distributed through apps, it gets a little gray. I think we've entered quite a bit of a gray area. And I think it's going to be harder for Apple to defend its position if it puts out a TV show like is being described, or a show over Apple Music like this Dr. Dre thing that's being described. But regardless, it does sound like it's going forward, and I fully expect it's something that will hit Apple Music. I'm curious how they're going to handle parental controls and things like that, but at this point, it does appear to be in development, although it seems to be the only show Apple has in active development at this point. There have been other rumors indicating that they're looking to do original shows and programming in other areas, that they're kind of exploring that, but maybe the plan is for them to cut their teeth on this show in Apple Music before moving on to producing more original content for the Apple TV and iTunes itself. But we're just going to have to wait and see how this goes and see if this show is a success or a flop. For my part, I'm just not into this kind of content, so it's personally for me not something I'll probably watch or be interested in watching. I may have to just for journalistic reasons, but I don't know. Based on the description, I'm not super excited about it. I'd be curious to know what you think. Is this a good way for Apple to enter this market, or is it something that might be a mistake moving forward? There was an interesting piece in ZDNet this week about Apple's plans to expand their operations into India. They're reporting that Apple plans on building a facility on 250,000 square feet of land in India. Apparently, they're going to be building in the Hyderabad IT corridor of India and building a facility that will reportedly cost them about $25 million, but is projected to involve about 4,500 jobs in the region. The report seems to indicate that it would be a center being set up to aid in the development of Apple's growing Apple mapping technology. So we were talking a little bit earlier about Apple looking to expand maps in iOS 10, and it sounds like a lot of the people working at this facility would be dedicated to that effort. Now, outside of just expanding their operations in the region, Apple also has been looking to expand their sales efforts in India. Last March, as a matter of fact, they reached over $1 billion in sales in India. And they've been working with the India government to try and get faster rollouts of Apple retail stores in the region. So I would imagine building a facility that would generate 4,500 jobs would go a long way into helping relations. Now, I'm not saying that's the only reason Apple would be building this facility in India, but it certainly couldn't hurt. And Apple Insider notes that there are a number of other places Apple has been expanding its international operations. And I found this very interesting because the list gets pretty extensive. And a lot of these facilities have been set up and developed more recently. And I just thought we'd go through the list, and I'm not really going to comment on it too much, but just take a load at where Apple is expanding their operations. They have manufacturing, customer care, finance, and global supply chain management in Cork, Ireland. I think that facility's been open there for a while. They have plans to open an iOS app development center in Naples, Italy. They have R&D offices in Cambridge in the UK. There are three development sites in Israel. They have an R&D facility under construction in Yokohama, Japan. And they are currently rumored to be moving into office space in Ottawa, Canada. And I think we talked about this on a recent episode, to work on automotive software solutions. And that's kind of, I guess, become a hub for like in-dash auto systems. As a matter of fact, BlackBerry has their QNX offices there. And BlackBerry QNX technology is in a lot of the Ford Sync systems, the more recent Ford Sync systems, I think, that are out there on the market, as well as other OEM manufacturer, you know, car integrated audio systems. So Apple vastly expanding their global operations. They also have been significantly adding to their offices in the United States. You have the new Campus 2 spaceship project that they're working on, and I think that's slated to be finished either later this year or early next year. I can't remember the exact date. They have all these new facilities that they're operating or are planning in places like Sunnyvale. That's where a lot of the rumored Apple Car stuff is going on. Santa Clara and San Jose. I think we've talked about some of the other buildings and things that they've been buying. They have a graphics chip development site in Orlando, Florida, and they've invested over about $300 million to expand their America's Operations Center in Austin, Texas. So no doubt that Apple is a big growing company. They've hired or acquired a number of corporations and resources over the past couple of years and are expanding quickly across the globe. And then finally in the news for this week, Apple has launched a worldwide replacement program for USB-C charge cables that shipped with the 12-inch Retina MacBook through June of 2015. Apple has discovered that in some cases, these cables will fail due to a design issue. The affected cables might fail to charge the MacBook or only charge intermittently when connected to a power adapter. You can tell if you have an impacted cable by its labeling, which is on the side, I think, near the connector, and it will read designed by Apple in California, assembled in China, and that's it. It will not have a serial number after it. If you have a cable that has a serial number after that label, then it's one of the redesigned ones, and it's not affected by this replacement program. Now, Apple will replace any faulty cables that shipped with the MacBook or also ones that were purchased separately. They'll do that at no cost to you. If you provided a valid mailing address when you registered your MacBook, then a new cable is going to be shipped to you automatically. You reportedly don't have to do anything. If you did not register your MacBook or maybe you purchased a cable separately, you should contact Apple support or an Apple authorized service provider or visit an Apple retail store, head into the Genius Bar to get a replacement cable, and you'll be able to replace any affected cables using this program through June 8th of 2018. So if you have a MacBook, you're going to want to check your cables and make sure that you're not part or that you are part of this worldwide replacement program. And with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank another show sponsor, and that is Harry's. Harry's gives you a high quality shave for a fraction of the price. One of my favorite things about being a Harry's customer is never again having to worry about buying razors or razor blades. I know it sounds like a very trivial thing, but it isn't. It's a pain. I mean, let's face it. We've all been in that situation where you've had that one blade or that one razor that you've used just too long, right? Because either you keep forgetting to buy new blades or you just didn't want to bother with it. And you say, I can just keep using this razor. And then the shave that you get completely sucks. You've got this tired, worn out blade. You get all kinds of razor burn, or worse, you nick yourself to death and you're putting little pieces of toilet paper on there trying to stop the bleeding. It's a horrible experience. And with Harry's, that never happens. You get a fresh supply of razors. You get shaving cream and shaving accessories whenever you need it and on a schedule that you control. So if you're a more frequent shaver, you can get them more frequently. If you're like me and shave a little less frequently, you can figure out the schedule that meets your needs. And now I never have to worry about changing out the blades on my razor because I always have new ones available. So if it's getting dull, I just throw the old one out. I know new ones are coming right to me. I don't have to go to the store. I don't have to worry about it. They're there. And I have to admit, I get very excited when my shipment of Harry's razors come, because the whole experience, even down to the packaging and the unwrapping of the packaging, it's enjoyable. I love getting razors. I know it's a weird thing to say, but because of Harry's, I just love it. And these guys are serious about shaving. I mean, they actually bought a factory in Germany so that they could create their own blades to their own specifications. I'm dead serious about that. And these are great 5-cartridge blades. They give you a great shave. And best of all, you don't have to take my word for it, because they're offering MacCast listeners a chance to try the Harry's Shave experience for free. They will send you a kit. It includes a razor handle, a Truman razor handle, a blade cartridge, a foaming shave gel, a travel blade cover, all for free. You just have to cover the $3 shipping charge, and you can try the Harry's Shave experience for yourself. And a few of you have gotten your kits already, and you told me you're loving it. I love hearing that. That's great to hear. Ping me on Twitter. Let me know when you get your shave kit and what you think. If you haven't got your trial yet, you can go to harrys.com/MacCast right now to start. That's harrys.com/MacCast, and you're going to get the best shave of your life. And again, you don't have to take my word for it, because they have a money-back guarantee, so you really have nothing to lose. And I just want to say a big thank you to Harry's for giving me a great shave and for sponsoring the show. You may remember a couple shows back at the end of January, I told you that Apple was removing the iTunes radio features from Apple Music Free and from iTunes Match, and moving those behind the paywall. If you want to get iTunes Radio beyond Beats 1, you're going to have to subscribe to Apple Music. And there were a number of people who were upset that iTunes Radio was being removed, specifically from iTunes Match, because it was really sold as a feature of that service. So now they're basically lessening the value of the service by taking that away. And a number of you expressed that, hey, I just had my subscription to iTunes Match renew, and now I'm getting less of a value. I really think that Apple should do something about that. And some people also feel that this is something that Apple's doing to try and force iTunes Match subscribers to move over to iTunes Music and the iCloud Music Library, which then your streamed or downloaded tracks come with the DRM applied to it rather than being DRM free. And we've talked about all these issues on the MacCast in the past. And I totally get and understand anybody who subscribes to iTunes Match and really doesn't have an interest in Apple Music being upset that this is basically a feature that I thought I was going to get access to, and now Apple is taking it away from me. And I suggested in that episode that those of you who are upset contact Apple and see what they would do, figuring that, you know, Apple probably is going to do something for those subscribers. It may or may not be exactly what you want, but they're probably going to take care of you. And I fully expect that at some point we're going to hear about a class action lawsuit over this. That's just the kind of thing that happens. But if you want to get a little bit more immediate relief, contact Apple. And I actually heard from some of you who did exactly what I recommended. And it does appear like Apple is giving those people who ask some iTunes Store credit if you subscribe to iTunes Music Match, and now Apple has removed this radio service. Now, I don't know if the value of that credit is going to be the same for everyone. It may be prorated or based on when Apple pulled the iTunes radio service from iTunes Match and when you had your renewal come up or when you subscribed to iTunes Match. But if you want a refund, I do encourage you to contact Apple. I don't think they've announced or reached out to everybody. I don't think this is something they're automatically doing it. It's not going to give you your iTunes radio back, unfortunately, but maybe it will at least take some of the sting out of losing the service. Here's an interesting little thing that I learned about this week. A bug that seems to indicate your iPhone doesn't like to go back to the past, and specifically the 70s. Now, for you or me, the 70s may be a decade that we'd like to go back to, or maybe not. I think I'm more in the not camp, but for sure it is one decade that your iPhone doesn't want to visit. This came out in an article on iMore. They had a piece this week about this really odd iPhone date bug that has apparently been with us since Apple released iOS 8. I was unaware of it, but what happens is if you manually set the date on your iPhone to January 1st, 1970, and then you reboot your phone, and don't do this. Do not do this. I'm going to tell you what about it, but don't do it. If you do that and reboot the phone, it can actually brick your phone to where you cannot get it back. You set that date, you reboot the phone, and it will not boot up. It will not boot into recovery mode. You will be stuck with a trip to the Genius Bar to get your iPhone up and running again. Now, obviously, this is very easy to avoid. The recommendation would be to keep the setting that allows your iPhone to just set its own date and time, or if you must set your iPhone date and time manually, do not set it to January 1st, 1970. And, you know, I don't know if this is related at all or not, but it seems likely. Apple has never been a company to look to the past. They're always kind of looking to the future. So I guess they wanted the same for the iPhone. One thing we talk about quite a bit on the MacCast is troubleshooting, how to deal with little bugs and issues that crop up on the Mac. And I often give you tips and tricks about dealing with hangs at boot up or spinning beach balls, app crashes, what happens when things lock up or you get a kernel panic. And we talk about how to troubleshoot them. But there's another kind of issue that can crop up from time to time. It's a little bit more rare, but I think it can be just as frustrating. And that's hangs at shutdown. You go to shut down your Mac, and it goes to that screen that I think is black or gray, and you get the little spinning gear, right? And you see that spinning gear there, and then it just sticks there, and it never really shuts down completely. Or you think you've shut it down, and you come back the next morning and realize it's still running, all kinds of stuff is going on, and you're like, I'm sure I tried to shut this machine down. Maybe the fans are spinning up. And this is exactly what happened to Jason Snell recently, and he wrote a great piece over on his Six Colors blog that had a great way of troubleshooting this kind of issue. And I had never thought about troubleshooting this kind of issue before. And by the way, if you're not reading his Six Colors blog at sixcolors.com, you really should be. It is a great Mac blog. Please check it out. But in the instance of, you know, how do you troubleshoot an issue that's happening at shutdown, the recommendation was, well, you know, boot into what's called verbose mode. And I think we've talked about single user and verbose mode on the MacCast in the past. But basically, if you hold down Command V while booting up your Mac, it will boot into verbose mode. If you hold down Command S, it boots into single user mode. And the difference between single user and verbose is when you boot into single user mode, when you're starting up the Mac, you're gonna see a screen full of information. It looks like you've just entered the Matrix. You're gonna see all kinds of, you know, what looks like DOS information. It's basically all of the boot up commands that are running normally in the background as you're seeing the little gray screen with the progress bar and all that sort of thing. But now you can actually view what's going on when you're booting up your Mac. And you'll see the same thing if you boot into verbose mode. But the difference is when you're in verbose mode, you're also going to see the same kinds of screens and information as you shut down the Mac. And that's why it's important to use verbose mode when you're trying to troubleshoot this shutdown hang. And what you'll see is these hidden, you know, this cryptic text that's going to go across your screen, but within that cryptic text could be the key to your hang. And in Jason's case, this is what he was looking for. When he was shutting down after enabling verbose mode, it would actually stop and fail at the point so he could see, okay, this is the process, this is the thing that's hanging up everything. And the message he got was failed to send exception xcorps notify error code 5 for PID, and then there's a number, right? And PID, that PID number was that key bit of information. For those of you who don't know, PID stands for process ID. And every application program, whether it's running in the foreground or background on your Mac, generates a process ID number. And that's how you know what application might be misbehaving. So what you need to do once you have the PID number is you need to be able to figure out, okay, what process, what thing running on my Mac actually triggered that? And there's typically an easy way to reference that, and that is through either a terminal command or looking in Apple's activity monitor. But the problem with a shutdown error is by the time you're shutting the machine down, even in verbose mode, you've now locked up and you have no way to access that information. So luckily, Jason had a friend who gave him some really great advice. He said, you know, why don't you capture the list of currently running processes before you shut down the computer? And luckily, there's a very simple terminal command to do that. I will have it in the show notes at maccast.com, but it's basically ps-x, and then you do a greater than. I always get my greater than and less than mixed up, but basically the one that points to the right, and then you create a text file. You just dump.txt would be a great name for that. You'll see the command in the show notes at maccast.com. But basically what you're going to do is you're going to dump the full list of running processes and their PID numbers to this text file. Then shut down the Mac in verbose mode. And when it stalls out, note the process ID, the PID number for that stalled process. Then you can force shut down the Mac, reboot it, and when it starts back up, you can open up that text file that's going to contain all of the processes and process ID numbers before you shut down the Mac, and you can identify which program is giving you the issue. I know, it's like brilliant. I don't know why I wouldn't have thought of that before, but thank goodness Jason and Jason's friend did, and they wrote it up. So in Jason's case, the culprit turned out to be the Adobe Creative Cloud Crash Reporter. I know, a little bit ironic, right? The thing that's supposed to look for crashes in Adobe software and report those to Adobe so they can fix bugs, that was causing Jason's Mac not to be able to shut down properly. And what he ended up doing was simply removing the Adobe CR daemon, which was the thing that controlled this, from starting up, and then he didn't have to worry about it anymore. And he's just going to wait until Adobe patches the software to get the fix in place. And I'm sure now that he's written it up, Adobe is, if they weren't already aware of it, are aware of it now, and will likely patch it quickly. And I thought this was a brilliant bit of troubleshooting and wanted to share the technique with you in case someday you find it useful. And also, it's just useful to know about process IDs and processes. So if you open up Activity Monitor on your Mac, you can see all of the programs that are running, and you can see their process IDs and which ones started other ones. So if one application kicks off another process, there's typically a provenance, you know, a history you can go through to kind of see what's going on. And it's just general good, helpful troubleshooting stuff. So a big thanks to Jason for writing that up on his blog this week. Brandon emailed me this week to ask about removing songs from his iPod. He wanted to free up storage, and he wanted to make sure that the music that he was removing from the iPod, he was only removing from the device itself and not from his iCloud music library. So I'm assuming, Brandon, you are an Apple Music subscriber, or this would actually even really apply if you're using iTunes Match. Basically, if you got music in the cloud that you want to be able to re-download and re-access later, you want to make sure it stays up there in the library, that it's not getting deleted from other devices, but you just want to remove the local copies that you've downloaded to your device. So basically, how do I get rid of any of the locally stored tracks on my device and not delete the data from the cloud? And Brandon noticed that when you would select a song or an album in the music app and then tap on the little dot, 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 little more section to bring up the little menu that would allow you to delete it, often it would say delete from my music. And the question was, well, what does that mean? What is delete from my music? Does that mean delete it from the My Music library of the music app? Or does that actually mean you're going to delete it from everywhere? And you'll note that when you tap that button, you do get a confirmation that also says delete from My Music. So they want to make doubly sure that you know, hey, we're going to delete this from your music. But what does that mean? And I looked at this and I thought, you know what, that is kind of confusing. So how do you delete music from the local device without actually deleting it from the iCloud music library? And what I've discovered is that the My Music part is key, Brandon, when figuring out what's going on. If you tap on that little menu icon, the menu comes up and the button shows just the word delete, dot, 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 that means that it's going to delete a track that is stored locally on your device and not remove it from My Music or the iCloud Music Library. If you see those words delete from My Music, it actually would delete that track from the cloud. So that's not a locally downloaded track. And you can see this when you tap the delete. So if you have downloaded a track and that button says delete, when you tap on it, the confirm dialog that comes up actually has not one, but two options. It'll have a delete from My Music option and a remove downloads option. And obviously the confirmation button that you want to click on is remove downloads, not delete from My Music. And it explains that if you read the text that appears in that dialog, it says this album or this track has been downloaded to this iPhone or iPod. If you do you want to delete it from My Music or remove the downloads from this iPhone, iPod, right? So very obvious that delete is deleting it locally. Delete from My Music is actually deleting it from the device and from the cloud. Now, another way you could tell if the file is local is when you're looking at the track or you're looking at the album, if you see a little, what looks like a little phone or a little iPod icon right next to that dot, dot, dot button to access the More menu on your device, then you know that is a file that's downloaded locally. I also noticed that when that menu comes up, if it's a track that's not stored locally, you'll see the little cloud download icon as well. So there's a number of indicators to indicate, is this a local file or is this a remote file? And so hopefully you find those helpful. Another thing you can do to make sure that you're only deleting locally downloaded tracks is just switch your view options. So when you're looking at the list view, at the top of the track list, you'll see that little drop down that allows you to switch between artists, albums, songs, whatever list view that you're looking at in music. So when you tap on that, at the bottom of the menu, you should see a little toggle button that says only downloaded music. If you turn that on, it's going to switch that view so that when you go back, you're only going to see music that was that has been downloaded locally to your device. And then you can safely just use that delete option to delete any tracks or albums from your device. Now, another thing to be aware of if you're trying to reclaim space on your device is that there is a streaming cache of anything that you streamed to that device, and that's not really easy to clear out. Really, the only way that I've found that works reliably for clearing that out is to actually turn the iCloud Music Library off and then turn it back on again. And I know that sounds a little bit extreme, but if you really need to reclaim that space, what you have to do is you have to go into Settings, into Music, and then turn off your iCloud Music Library. You don't need to turn off Apple Music. You can leave that on, but you turn off the iCloud Music Library, and then you turn it back on and it wipes out all of that data locally on your device. It will reclaim any of that streaming storage space. But that's how you delete files locally from your device without deleting from your iCloud Music Library, Brandon. And I hope this tip has helped you out. And then last but not least for this week, by far, is my thing of the moment. This is something I've been waiting on. It's a game I've been waiting for this game to come out for over a year. Since I saw the trailers, I was super excited about this thing to come out. And the game is called Firewatch. It is a collaboration between a small indie studio in San Francisco called Campo Santo and Panic. If you probably know Panic, they're the makers of great Mac apps like Coda and Transmit. And I so far have been totally blown away by this game. I'm really enjoying playing it. I can't wait to get back to it. I guess my biggest regret is I can't play it enough. I don't have enough time. And if you're wondering what this thing is, the developers describe it as a mystery set in the Wyoming wilderness where your only emotional lifeline is the person on the other end of a handheld radio. And the way I would describe it is as a story-driven first-person exploration-style game. It's kind of like a little bit of a puzzle game, but really I think in a lot of ways, intellectual. You're trying to figure things out. You're trying to figure out the emotions of this character. You play this guy named Henry who, through basically a series of emotional, personal events, finds himself employed as a park service ranger in a fire watch tower. So he's in one of these wilderness watchtowers. And the only other main character in the game, as the previous description described, is your supervisor, a woman named Delilah, and you just communicate with her over the radio. So you don't see her. She's just giving you tasks to do, sending you out on missions, telling you to go check out this thing or that thing. And you're kind of exploring, or you're left on your own to kind of explore around this wilderness environment. And there's, you know, great interactions, like you have to get into, you know, places to find more equipment and hook up ropes, and you're climbing down ropes and you're walking all over. And it is just visually beautiful. And you guide the gameplay through your conversations and through your own adventuring and actions and things like that. So it's a little bit like choose your own adventure when you're having these conversations with Delilah. You'll get asked questions, and then you kind of get to pick and guide which way you want it to go and what kind of personality you're going to portray and have, and how much personal information do you want to share and not share, and what are you going to keep secret. And then there's a whole other storyline that's going along with what's happening in the game, and you're trying to figure out and make sense of that and what's going on here, and different events are happening, and you're getting little clues and trying to figure stuff out. But like I said, the visual style to me of this game is stunning. It's really unique, not like anything that I've ever seen before, and the story really draws you into the game. And because I don't have a ton of time, I'm only about 3 days. Each level in the game is kind of separated into a day, so I'm 3 days into the game. But every time I come back, I'm totally drawn in, and I don't want to stop playing. I gotta force myself to stop playing. It's really that good. And it's available for Mac on Steam right now. It's $19.99 US. As far as the system requirements go, it does require OS 10, 10.8 or later. They recommend a 2011 or newer Intel Core i5 processor, 6 GB of RAM, NVIDIA or ATI GPU with 1 GB of memory, at least 4 GB of available disk space, and it does require a dedicated graphics card. So if you have a Mac Mini model, it's currently not supported. Now, my machine was on the very edge of kind of those specifications, and actually my GPU, an AMD Radeon HD 6490M 256 megabyte, is below the recommendations. So I have a 2011 Core i7 2.0 gigahertz Mac Pro with 8 GB of RAM, and the game runs, but I had to crank things way down to get it to be playable. So I'm very much on the edge, but even with everything turned all the way down, it plays fairly well, and I think it looks great. I'm really enjoying it. So I can only imagine, if you have a better machine, what the graphics look like. And when I first turned it on, it was at full, you know, full resolution, full frame rate and all that stuff, and it was really, really choppy. So I had to kind of crank everything down. But again, because it's such a story-driven game and more of an intellectual game, there's not a lot of fast-paced action and jumping, and it's not, you know, run 'em, shoot 'em up kind of first-person game. I'm getting a lot of enjoyment out of playing it, and I really recommend it. You can go to firewatchgame.com. You can check out the trailers if you want to see what it's all about. But these guys did an excellent job, and I'm really looking forward to seeing more stuff from this new Campo Santo studio. I think it's excellent, excellent stuff, and really worth checking out. So that's why this week, Firewatch is my thing of the moment. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors: Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disk Label, also Text Expander for iOS, along with PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad, as well as PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can get more information and details and check out all of their great software by visiting smilesoftware.com. And Gazelle. Gazelle is the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products are worth by going to gazelle.com. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. If you have any feedback for me, a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send me emails or audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline. That number is 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. If you need show notes with links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you'd like to follow me online between shows, if you use social media, Twitter, Facebook, Google+, we have MacCast communities everywhere. You can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. Or you can check out the Google Plus community. That's at google.com/plusMacCast. And that's the plus symbol. But that is going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.